listener production.
Fast forward 10 years, you will see logistics be a bigger and bigger part of e-commerce. Yes, there's lots of complicated stuff that happens in the middle, but bottom line is, customer clicks a button, box has to show up at the door. I describe at a very basic level that when people say, well, what do? I say, well, I move boxes around the country. Because logistics is core to e-commerce.
G'day, I'm Scott Phillips and welcome to the Good Oil Podcast, where we give you the good oil on business, finance, the economy, what's really going on in our world. We're going to talk to the people who make it happen, the CEOs, entrepreneurs, business people, and the people who can break it down for us, the economists and experts, the people who spend their lives trying to work out what's making this world turn. And my guest is Ruslan Kogan, the CEO and founder of Kogan.com. The conversation couldn't happen at a better time. E-commerce is going through the roof. This company added $400 million in sales alone in the last 12 months to do a total of $1.2 billion in sales. This is a very fast-growing business in a very fast-growing and important industry that I think you're really going to want to know about. We cover the fact that Kogan is more an engineering and stats business than it is a retailer, believe it or not. We go into the importance of supply chain in winning the e-commerce war. And we talk about the importance of Kogan's marketplace business, where Kogan gets to be a platform to connect buyers and sellers and clip the ticket along the way. It was a fantastic conversation. I really think you're going to enjoy it. Here's Ruslan Kogan. Ruslan Kogan, welcome to The Good Oil.
Thank you for having me. Absolute pleasure to be here.
Oh, mate, you're very kind. Thank you for spending your time with us. I'm excited for the conversation and I'm excited that listeners get to hear directly from you, mate. It is a wonderful success story. I should say up front, I am a Kogan shareholder, so thank you for the return so far, but also thank you for appearing on the podcast. Let's start, I guess, with today. Now, of course, you can't give us, and I wouldn't ask for any material non-public information, so I don't want any of that stuff, but from a guy on the coalface, we're recording this in early September 2021, I guess I'm just curious what you're seeing as we kind of battle through these lockdowns that have more than half of us all but confined to home. As you look over the retail landscape, your business, around the country, things you're hearing, how are you seeing the economy and the way we're traveling through COVID?
Yeah, look, from one perspective, it's tough. Like, in Melbourne here, I believe this week broke the world record for the most lockdown city in the world.
Oh, jeez.
Okay. Which
that's not a record you want.
Well, yeah. Well, look, we're proud of the fact that in Melbourne, if we do something, we do it properly. So, you know, we do have an amazing sporting precinct and competitiveness runs in our blood.
Yes.
But yeah, that's probably a record that that we don't want. And in general, just chatting to people and, there's lots of industries that are really struggling and, you know, you can't help but feel really sorry for them. Like chatting to my trainer and the whole, you know, all the gyms and training industry, they have absolutely copped it the last 18 months. Or those in hospitality, catering and so on. So from an e-commerce perspective, as logic would suggest, that when people are spending more time at home, they are shopping more online. And you never want to be winning in a pandemic. Like, we would far prefer for e-commerce in Australia to grow and accelerate under normal conditions. But to a degree, look, since 2006, I was out there saying that e-commerce is a big part of our future and talking about the benefits of e-commerce. And a lot of our business leaders and traditional retailers were saying that online retail would never be a meaningful part of retail. And it has grown slowly in Australia and is significantly behind the rest of the world. And even now with the pandemic, yes, more and more customers have learnt about the benefits of online shopping, but it's still way behind the rest of the world. But at least we're now in a position where you switch on the TV and you see some of our biggest retailers telling customers to go online and shop online. And we as a business love an environment where more and more customers would start their shopping experience by opening their laptop or taking out their smartphone. So from that perspective, it's a positive for e-commerce.
It is worth mentioning too. It was only last week, so again, the first week of September, when we saw the, I think it was the July retail sales that were down meaningfully across the country, down most in New South Wales, I guess, because we were last to a lockdown, this time around, and hardest hit. But also, it's hard not to see that in a month where retail sales were down meaningfully, online sales, e-commerce sales actually hit another monthly record. And I think that just underscores the evidence you're seeing. No one could have predicted the pandemic. You didn't, I didn't. But it is one of those things where, fortune does favour the prepared, I suppose.
Well, yeah, that's definitely true. It's been a case of preparation meets opportunity. And we've been scaling our systems and processes for a long time. And just even the last year has been an incredibly challenging period from that perspective. If you think about the scale that Kogan.com is getting and what we're building, as you said, we did $1.2 billion of sales. The systems you need for that is completely different to what you need to run an e-commerce operation that's doing $50 or $100 or $200 or $300 million. It's a completely different proposition. Just even ensuring that customers receive their order confirmation emails in a quick way, that the tracking emails go out quickly, that the orders get updated, that the logistics works, that absolutely every element of the business is a completely different engineering problem to solve. So we have been able to solve a problem in the last year of growing an e-commerce company by $400 million. We went from around $800 million to $1.2 billion of sales while working from home and doing it digitally. So it's been a tremendous year from that perspective and the challenges that our amazing team has had to overcome.
It is worth saying, I think you're right. I talked about the percentages, but the sheer dollars, I imagine the growth over the past year, just the dollar value of that growth is probably bigger than most e-commerce retailers alone, let alone you grew from an already very large size to a much larger size in the process. I was going to ask you this later, but maybe it's worth talking about now. How would you characterize the last 12 months? Is it easier as you get bigger? Is it harder as you get bigger? Is it just as hard with different sorts of problems? How does that kind of roll out in your mind?
Look, you certainly, as you get bigger, you get the benefits of scale. So it makes a lot of things much easier, like convincing suppliers or manufacturers to want to do business with you, negotiating prices, attracting the best talent in the country and so on. So all of those things get much easier with scale, but the engineering problems you solve get more complicated. So when you're a $100 million business and you can buy off-the-shelf software that can solve a lot of your problems for you, there's no off-the-shelf software for running $1 billion plus of e-commerce and making sure that the customer contact is spot on and you've got all of the personalization happening and all the various promotion systems and marketing systems and algorithms and advertising. And, you don't really know how good your roof is until it starts to rain heavily. And then you plug a few holes and then you don't know how good your roof is until it rains heavily for a few days. And then, and so on. So you keep learning as a business things and areas that you need to improve.
It's interesting, mate. I think I've heard you, I think it's attributed to you, it may not be, Kogan described as a market, as a data company that happens to sell things. That the business itself is very much everything's a tech business these days, but Kogan truly sees itself as a technology business. Even as you mentioned that though, you've mentioned the word engineering a couple of times, and I wonder whether, is it still a data business? Is it an engineering business? Are they the same thing and with two sides of the same coin? I'm curious how you see Kogan as a business these days.
They're very related. What I've been saying for a while is that, we're a statistics business masquerading as an e-commerce company.
There we go, thank you.
And that is completely still the case, and I think it will be the case forever. In our very early days, we realized that what we had created was a very efficient supply chain. Our private label exclusive brands business was the most efficient way to get a product from point of manufacture into the customer's hands. And what we're doing is we're managing the flow of information around that, ensuring that, you know, we're tendering products for manufacturing, we're playing factories off against each other, we're picking the best ones with the best quality, we're then managing the supply chain to get the products into Australia, we're then managing the promotion and delivery to the customers, and all of the data around that, whether it be the how fast the shipping times are or the product reviews for the products and comparing one product to another, to the demand metrics, to what our customers are searching on the website, what the conversion rates of various products are, and so on. And then you take that information and you optimize from there, and you make sure that the next product is even better. And that is even more the case now than ever before. We're there to be able to take our platform and be able to alter it for our customers and be able to do what our customers need and to delight all of them. And the information is so important, because I've had in the past, for instance, people would come up to me when I'd speak at an entrepreneur conference and say, hey, I'm doing this venture, here's my website, can you tell me if my website is any good? And my response was always the same. I'd say to them, look, my opinion as to whether your website is good or not is irrelevant. What does the data say? What pages are your customers looking at? What pages are causing your customers to leave? What pages are causing your customers to spend more time on your site? Just look at the data, look at the information, and keep optimizing your business to better suit your customers. And that is what a good e-commerce operation is all about. Use your platform to better serve your customers.
I'm old enough, Ruslan, to have worked in retail, both retail and supplying retail food and beverage background. And in that time, I can still remember, this is kind of pre-internet or very early days of the internet, and they were putting goggles on people to see what products they were looking at, how long they were looking at the products, what they were picking up and considering. And I hadn't really even, I mean, obviously it's the same. I hadn't thought about this until you just mentioned it then, which is effectively you guys get to do that natively because you know all that stuff. You don't have to put goggles on people. I mean, I guess you'd be interested to see what part of the page they looked at, but you know the page, you know, linger times, you know what they're moving from and to, how long they're staying, all that kind of stuff, the products they're buying. I guess to some degree, the internet is it's almost designed with that thought in mind, right? You can use those stats because that's the native content of the internet itself.
Well, definitely. And I think that it's up to every business to be able to flaunt its competitive advantages to better look after its customers. And there's pros and cons in each channel or each type of business. Like, for instance, if you walked into a Nespresso store, you could smell the aromas of the various coffees. They could get you to try different coffees, try different coffee machines and so on. Like, that is not an experience we'll ever be able to create online. That is a huge competitive advantage for them and a reason why those stores will always do booming trade. But they can't collect, you know, they can't collect information that can help them improve the customer experience as well. Yes, they know which customers tried which coffee and they could see the facial expression and, you know, they can add a bit more of that human touch and be able to tailor experiences that way. In a digital world, we're able to tailor experiences for the individual far more easily. We know if one customer is more interested in a certain category than another customer. We know that, hey, these products aren't really converting customers that well, so there's no need to show them near the top of the page, whereas these products are. It would be the equivalent, what we are able to do in the digital world, if we were to translate it into a traditional retail environment, it's probably the equivalent of, say, a store being able to change its layout for every single customer.
Yeah, right. So that's a pretty big advantage online.
Yeah, so if you walked into this store and, you know, they know that you recently bought a TV, they will put the Blu-ray players near the front, knowing that you might be interested in a Blu-ray player.
Right.
Or if you bought a Blu-ray player recently, they might put a few Blu-ray movies or and so on. Or these days, everything's streamed anyway. But, you know, just as an example of something a store might do. Whereas if the next customer walks in and, you know that they're really interested in home automation, then you'll have all the home automation stuff right at the front of the store. So being able to alter a store design per customer is something that is a huge advantage to digital online retailers that have great engineering teams and are keeping up with technology.
It's remarkable. I do have to ask you, how much of that experience you just explained to me, or that process you just explained to me, is manual versus automated? I guess you've got to have some sense of what you want to do or how you want to do it. But equally, these days, deep AI and other things can tell you what you should do differently. I'm wondering how many questions you actually have to ask, or how many strategies you deliberately need to bring to the table versus literally just letting the data bubble up.
Oh, it's all, you know, you've got the behavior of your customers on your platform, and then you've got what you're going to do with it and how you're going to better improve the customer experience with it. Because ultimately, that's all it comes down to. Like, you know, how am I going to make the shopping experience for this person better next time they're on our website? And it's a win-win, because if you make their experience better, they're more likely to buy something and you're more likely to make more money as a business. So, and they're not wasting time. But there are a lot of buzzwords in this space. So you'll struggle to attend any conference or visit any provider of any sort of e-commerce services without seeing big data, AI, algorithms, like all of these buzzwords flying around. But to actually be able to use your platform to improve the customer experience takes a lot of engineering intent and learning. So some do it well, some pretend to do it, and some don't do it at all.
Right, and I imagine the results, as you would expect in those three groups, are they?
Pretty much.
Mate, so you mentioned using the coffee machine and smelling the coffee and that kind of stuff. And I obviously Smell-O-Vision has never quite taken off, despite being in the Jetsons and sci-fi for many, many years. I don't know if Star Trek ever had it, but they couldn't have been far away. I'm curious as to, you obviously are an early technology adopter. You guys are at the forefront of trying new things. I remember the reverse auction you used to run many years ago, where if you got an early, you get the TV for a cheaper price because it was going to be made in a couple of weeks or a month. And the earlier you order it and the longer you're prepared to wait, the better the price you got. I'm curious, you mentioned, as I said, the coffee machines. Is there an augmented reality, virtual reality future for Kogan or for online retail? Is that, can you guys close that gap? Or do you just simply say, you know what, it's never going to be us. If they want to shop in store, they can. If they want to shop in store, they buy from us, they can. We only know so much we can do, and we're not going to waste time. Or is it literally a case of, hey, we want to be as close as we possibly can and capture every possible customer and dollar?
You've got to let customers guide you on that journey. Like what you're talking about is, we launched and trademarked and launched this technology called Live Price, which makes perfect economic sense, because it says money now is worth more than money later. There is a time value of money. So customers who are willing to pre-purchase things in advance should receive the benefit for it. And somebody who's willing to pre-purchase a product 45 days out should receive a much bigger benefit than somebody who's willing to pre-purchase 30 days out, and so on. And so we built this algorithm where products had a price that kept moving as it approached the time of the product release. From an economics perspective and scientific perspective, made absolute perfect sense.
But
but customers didn't give a shit.
Is that right? I'm pretty sure I bought a TV from you guys using Live Price back in the day.
Maybe you were one of the only ones. And so you've got to listen to customers. You've got to say, if customers don't care about this, if this isn't a concept that they appreciate and it's not working, we can it, we chuck it in the bin, we move on to the next one. Our job is to dissect the world of technology and possibilities and inventions and give our customers exactly what they want. if our customers love it, if our customers interact with it, if they're using it more and more, great, that's wonderful. And there's been technology like this, the lots of things stick and they're great and customers love it and use it, but some you can tell from the start, this isn't really heading anywhere. Like, I remember with 3D TV, I was, and it, you know, if you look back over the media history of that cycle, I was out there straight away saying, hey, our data is showing customers do not care about 3D TV. They care more about other features like a built-in PVR at the time, which was the ability to pause and rewind live TV. And I was talking about that publicly, but if you looked around advertising, there was still a lot of 3D TV stuff going on. And I was saying, well, people, you know, sitting around on the couch watching TV is quite a social event. You know, you have your mates around.
Yeah, right.
You have your mates around for the footy or you watch a movie. And eye contact is a massive part of being social. So putting goggles on and sitting around on the couch, yes, you might get away with it once or twice for the novelty, but customers won't be having a bar of it. And it's exactly what our data was showing, and it's exactly what ended up happening. So yes, there will be heaps of technology and AI and augmented reality. Let the customers decide. Like, we will build it, we will experiment. If customers love using it, great. We will invest more in it. If customers don't care about it, then we will say, look, we tried, we'll put it in the bin and we'll move on to the next thing.
It sounds to me, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounds to me like Kogan as a business is just not, you know, not wedded to anything in particular. You know, plenty of the old school business stories, and they're great stories and they're successful stories, are the people who made it, took a big punt on X and just loved it and loved it and loved it, and eventually they were right. You know, Steve Jobs invents the iPhone, creates a market. It's a wonderful business. In another universe, he invents the iPhone. No one likes it. And we're still using, you know, Nokia flip phones or something. But in your case, it sounds like you're kind of saying, look, you know what? We can't afford to want to be wedded to anything. We don't need to make those big calls. We don't need to have those polemic kind of, you know, opinions on anything. We can simply just shift as the customers do.
Well, yeah, we know e-commerce is going to be much bigger in the future. We know that we as a business are winning massive market share. And we know that with the use of technology, we can experiment with various things and seeing what our customers love. And the beauty with innovation is as well that, like, some of it just seems, you know, when you do it, it's innovative. But when you look back on it, it's like, oh, this just made sense right. The whole time. Like, why didn't we do this earlier?
Yeah.
I was actually watching the released Steve Jobs released the iPhone the other day. I watched the full video, and I remembered one point in it where he showed the pinch and zoom functionality and the crowd went wild. Like, they had not seen pinch and zoom. Now for us, it's like pinch and zoom is just like,
isn't that incredible?
For us, it's just common functionality. If something doesn't have pinch and zoom, you think it's broken. Whereas in 2007, that was earth-shattering stuff. And for us now, we look at our business and we go, why didn't we launch the marketplace 10 years ago? Like, why did we only do it 2 years ago? Like, this makes so much sense. How did we ever function as a business without this? So you have to be very willing to test and learn lots of things and learn quickly in a business.
Every good superhero needs an origin story. I'm not sure if Kogan Man's going to be a superhero anytime soon, but I am interested in the origin story. So I'm curious. I guess the idea at the beginning is obviously interesting for our listeners, many of whom are either current or budding entrepreneurs, but also the journey. How did you learn and grow both individually and as a business to some of the things you've shared with us now? Maybe you had those ideas way back in the day, or maybe you've kind of, you know, just learned them as you've gone, or learned them from other people. What's the Kogan journey itself for you personally been like?
Yeah, well, look, it certainly from the start wasn't one where I thought, look, I've got this idea that I'm going to turn into a business that's going to do over $1 billion of sales. I was in a corporate job, fairly techie. I always had the latest mobile phone, often imported it from Asia because technology was always released in Australia as like one of the last countries in the world. And when I wanted to buy a flat screen TV, the shops all had crazy prices around $5,000 each. It was just when flat panels were starting out. So I contacted a few factories out of Asia, thought I'll import one, save a bit of money. Once they started coming back with quotes, I saw that I could land a TV for a few $1,000s that the other stores are selling for $5,000.
Right, okay.
And then I learned about the industry and saw that the panel, which is the major component in a TV, the LCD panel, was only at that point made by LG, Hitachi, Samsung and Sharp. So no matter what brand of TV you bought in the world, there were hundreds of brands, one of those had made it. And it made me think to a direct-to-consumer online business model and doing things efficiently, and that's how, you know, that was the birth of Kogan. At the start, it was a, hey, this will help me get out of my corporate job.
It's always a good motivator.
Type of venture, yeah. And then it's like as it kept growing and growing, you know, it's been a dream. It's a challenging environment. We're in some of the most competitive industries, and I've been able to assemble a world-class team, and that's what makes me jump out of bed in the morning, the fact that we get to innovate and debate ideas with some of the best people in the industry. We get to be at the forefront of an industry as well, because e-commerce in Australia has been significantly behind the rest of the world, and we're just riding the wave. And like I mentioned before, you know, I think now the estimates are at 10 to 13% that e-commerce is of retail. There's some estimates saying that it'll get to 40%, and we've continued to win market share as we've grown in that space. So I can't think of a more exciting space to be in. But at each point in time, we have assessed our customer offering and said, how can we improve this? What else can we do? How can we make things more affordable? How can we make things more accessible? And how can we use technology to delight more customers and improve their experience? And the business has just kept evolving, and here we are, you know, just recently celebrating our 15th birthday.
Remarkable. Speaking of that, early in the journey, I wouldn't be surprised if the first I heard of Kogan.com was when a young bloke called Ruslan Kogan pretty much called Jerry Harvey out. I seem to recall plenty of newspaper coverage of a war of words of sorts, where you might have mentioned him obliquely early on when you said some people said that online wasn't going to work, and I think that might have been Jerry's words, or close enough to them. I'm curious, just that process. I mean, obviously some great free guerrilla marketing, obviously something you obviously truly also believed in. How serious was the war of words, mate? Was it genuinely out there to kind of stick one to Jerry, or was it more a matter of saying, hey, I've got something to say, and anyone versus Jerry is a good news story?
Well, it's interesting because, look, Jerry's an incredible businessman if you look at what he's achieved, like the Harvey Norman empire and the quantum of sales and profitability that it generates is an absolute aspirational thing to most entrepreneurs. Like he's changed the face of retail in Australia. But that whole, the war of words with Jerry is interesting because it was actually inspired by when I was growing up and I liked listening to hip hop and listening to Eminem. And then I remember in college, I was listening to Eminem, and then Ja Rule attacked Eminem, and then I hadn't heard of Ja Rule much at the time, and I listened to what Ja Rule had to say, then Eminem responded, then Ja Rule responded, and I kept downloading all the responses.
Right.
And then I remember Eminem ended it by saying, I'm not going to respond anymore because I've sold you more records than you could ever sell yourself. And I thought, you know what, that's so true, because I'd never listened to Ja Rule before, and here I was listening to what he and Eminem had to battle with each other. So then in the early days of the business, I thought, well, we're a challenger brand here, and every challenger brand has an enemy. And then I thought, well, here you've got a big store with a huge cost base that spends a lot of money on advertising, and I was filming a story that Today Tonight had come out to our office to do about how our TVs are so cheap. And I egged them on a bit when the cameras were off, and I said, if you show this to Jerry, he will absolutely lose it. If he would see these prices, wow, I have no idea how he would react. And then the whole office, and it was about 10 of us at the time, had gathered that evening to watch the Today Tonight episode, and we'd ordered pizzas and we're sitting around the TV, and here comes a story on the TV, and there's Jerry with a printout of our website going, oh, their prices aren't that cheap. This TV's only a couple of hundred bucks cheaper. And that just blew up the war of words. And then so then I egged the media on a bit, and I was like, it was around election time, so I offered to do a live debate. And before you know it, the media loves a bit of conflict. And here it was, Kogan versus Harvey Norman, at a time when our sales probably would have been around $8 million a year and Harvey Norman was doing billions. But, you know, so while the battle wasn't that material or significant, like, you know, we were a fly on the industry. But the message of what it got through was significant, being that the e-commerce business model is coming and it's growing quickly and it can benefit customers a lot.
And it sounds like Jerry Harvey is the real Slim Shady.
pretty much.
Mate, you mentioned the marketplace before, and it is, we've had you speak at one of our member events before, and I appreciate you doing that. And you were very generous. I said, look, you know, to some degree, you remind me, Kogan reminds me of Amazon to some degree. The evolution of your business is not that far away. And I said, I hope that's not an insult. You said, no, you were very flattered by the comparison. You are in a business that has many, many categories, including white label products and selling other people's services, money, telecommunications. This is a business that is growing, as you say. You're looking to more categories. And the marketplace is, if not the latest version, certainly an example of exactly what they've been doing. So I don't want to necessarily say that you're going to be as big as Amazon, but there's a market there for you. I am curious, though, as to if you think about what the future looks like for Kogan, how is the sky the limit? How far do you go? How wide do you go? What does that look like?
Well, yeah, look, at a very fundamental level, we've managed to grow the business and win significant market share while our industry continues to grow very quickly. So that's obviously the goal for our business. We think e-commerce will continue to grow very quickly, and we will continue to grow our market share within that industry by delighting our customers. From a business structure perspective, we've always been ones to, like I said before, let our customers guide what they want. We don't want to push anything down our customers' throats. We don't want to tell our customers this is what you should be buying, or stop buying this category, buy this category. Like, our customers define what our product range looks like, what we allocate capital to, what inventory we get, and which product divisions are featured. Our marketplace and enabling Australian retailers and businesses to sell through our platform is one of the fastest growing areas in our business. It launched a couple of years ago and is already generating hundreds of millions of dollars of sales. It has a huge pipeline of sellers that are in the process of onboarding onto our platform. But you're right in regards to saying, well, look, you know, Amazon is now a very similar business model, and it's completely true. Like, we've gone about our business from a first principles perspective. You know, it started off as a private label only exclusive brands business, because that way we didn't have to beg anyone for supply. We didn't have to convince anyone to supply us. We were in full control of the supply chain end to end. We won lots of customers. We added third party brands. We then built a customer base, and we said, hey, lots of service providers will be interested in being able to do partnerships with us. So we did the Kogan Mobile, Kogan Internet, Kogan Money, Kogan Credit Card, and so on. And then we said, well, now that we've got this amazing ecosystem, let's allow other sellers to access that ecosystem. And we've done that, and it's been growing very quickly. So we've got the divisions like exclusive brands, which is growing really quickly in its 15th year. And then we've got divisions like marketplace, which are growing very quickly as well. If we look to an Amazon and markets where they've reached maturity, like say the US, it indicates that our marketplace will probably get to 60 to 70% of our sales. That's what the evolution likely looks like. Marketplace has this beautiful element to it where it's massively increased our product range. So since launching Marketplace, we've gone from a few thousand products on our site to over 10 million items on our site. It enables us to scale infinitely without needing any additional capital. So it is a division that the business is really focused on. It's a division where we're dedicating a lot of effort to building out the platform and the functionality and ensuring marketplace health and helping sellers onto the platform, and it's a very exciting thing for our business.
Is that is there international opportunity? Is there other category opportunities? There's always risk with any brand, any business. You know, overreach is a killer. Equally, often there's plenty of opportunity. And to your point, if your differentiation is actually in being able to simply match up customers with the products they like and at a good price, which is kind of the core of Kogan DNA, I suppose, or at least the way I see it from the outside, there doesn't seem to be a natural limit as long as you're delivering on the broad brand promise.
Well, look, we expanded internationally with the Mighty Ape acquisition. And while we did have operations in New Zealand, they're nowhere near the scale of what Mighty Ape gives us. And that is an incredible business that's been delighting customers for a very, very long time. Mm. And in fact, when we look at the culture in that business and our business and the history of the businesses, they're very, very similar. So that gives us a significant footprint into New Zealand, and there's a lot of synergies that will come with that as well. We've realised some of the synergies already. Some are taking a bit longer because we've had to cancel 3 trips to New Zealand because in the last moment we go into lockdown. So
that'll happen.
while we've made that acquisition nearly a year ago, we haven't actually been able to get over there and spend time with the team yet. So we're very much looking forward to that. But at a high level, there is so much opportunity for us in Australia and New Zealand. Like if you look at our business, just taking high level numbers into account. So we're roughly $1 billion of sales in what's roughly a $30 to $40 billion e-commerce market. So we're about 3% call it of e-commerce. And e-commerce is roughly 10% of retail. So we are 0.3% of retail. So as much as like the scale we have achieved has not been achieved by any Australian online retailer or any Australian e-commerce company. And yes, it's amazing that we managed to grow sales by $400 million in the last year. But when you look at it in the scope of the entire retail market, even with all of that growth, we're 0.3% of retail. So that's where the opportunity is. The big opportunity is even not even so much in competing with other online retailers. The big opportunity is in the big chunk of retail that's going to swap over from traditional retail to e-commerce over the next 10, 20 years.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right. I guess as we start to wind up, I'm loath to ask you this question because you've been very clear to say, look, I'll let the data guide, I'll let the customers guide us. But if you look out 5 or 10 years, maybe someone who's closer to the industry than anyone listening, you're obviously at the forefront of the industry, not only close to it. I guess I'll just ask you, look into the crystal ball. What does it look like 10 years' time? Size, scale, components, technology, features? What does the e-commerce of 2031 look like?
I'm just, with you asking the question, I'm thinking back, like if we looked at 2011 and you asked me in 2011, what will it look like in 2021?
Yeah, right.
Would I have even been close?
Yeah.
And the answer is probably 50-50. There's a lot of things that have happened that in 2011 that have played out exactly how we said it would, but some completely differently, like Marketplace. Like in 2011, our offering was pretty much exclusive brands only. We had just started to dip our toes in third-party brands. Fast forward 10 years, you will see logistics be a bigger and bigger part of e-commerce. And it's going to come down to which operators have the scale to give customers the logistics experience that customers need, being that I place an order, it has to arrive really quickly. Yes, there's lots of complicated stuff that happens in the middle, but bottom line is customer clicks a button, box has to show up at the door. I describe at a very basic level that when people say, well, what do? I say, well, I move boxes around the country because logistics is right. core to e-commerce. So the logistics piece will be very important. Having fast and rapid delivery to customers will be very important. Having a competitive advantage will be very important. Our exclusive brands division, which makes up over 50% of the GP in our business, that's our Netflix originals. That's what's been driving customers to our side for 15 years because it's the most efficient way to get a product from point of manufacture into the customer's hands. And customers know they can come to Kogan.com and get a deal that not only is an amazing price, but nothing similar exists anywhere else. So they're the key pieces of the puzzle that, you know, need to fall into place. And we're doing a lot of work to build it. A fundamental business performance metric, we will be expecting our business to continue to gain market share in a very fast growing market.
I like it. As a shareholder, mate, I'm happy to hear it. Let me finish off with our four standard questions, if I can. I guess the first one, you mentioned Netflix. Our listeners are always looking for recommendations. Is there anything particular you're watching, streaming, reading, listening to on podcasts? Any recommendations you'd have for our audience, the things they should be checking out?
Believe it or not, I barely watch TV. And when I do, it's to watch sport. So given that the NBA season is finished, the Olympics are finished, and my football team Essendon gave me a little bit of excitement thinking there might be a bit of September action, we're now back to, nah, there isn't. So, there's not that much that I watch.
I'm a Swans fan in the AFL, so I know I feel your pain. I'm a Roosters fan, and at the time of recording, at least, we're still in the game, but we'll see how that pans out this weekend. I guess the next question I tend to ask is what trends are you watching? Now, we talk a lot about trends over the last 45 minutes or so, but just generally, whether it's about your business or your role or the economy, society, the world, obviously online retail, the growth of that's the obvious one. Anything else you're seeing, you're fascinated by that's happening in the world today, you kind of have half an eye, just keeping an eye on?
Well, most of the trends I'm watching is related to our business. So on a daily basis, we're seeing, you know, how many customers are coming to our site, what are they after, is there categories that customers are more interested than others, are we allocating capital to inventory correctly? Right now, one of the ones that, you know, is occupying a lot of attention is supply chain disruptions. So we're seeing that there's a lot of shipping disruptions. There's a lot of cost of shipping has gone up considerably. And there's been a lot of documented issues that we've had in our business around excess inventory. Now, the conversations are shifting from, do we have too much to do we have enough? Which is a good position to be right in, but it's monitoring and watching all of that, because we've also got a scenario where there's a lot of inflationary pressures in the economy, and monitoring whether, you know, they are, as some commentators say, transient, or whether they're here to stay, and how all of those will interact in the business world. There's a lot, and then the other one, I guess, that is important is checking in with our team. Like, one of the challenges to working from home is the team culture. We've got an environment now where there's, I think it's 34% now of our team has never been to our office.
Oh, wow.
So they've been hired through this environment and maintaining culture. Some are doing it tough, checking in, making sure, that we maintain that. There's sometimes a sort of metrics that can be overlooked, but for an organization, this is a very challenging environment. And while we're much better off than most others who aren't cloud first and digital first type companies, it's easier for us, but it's still a big challenge.
Yeah, so with the personal issues, I like that. Mate, you've spoken a lot about both successes and the challenges of entrepreneurship over the last little while, but I wonder what advice you would give to someone who is listening to you and saying, you know what, I'd like to start my own business, maybe an e-commerce business, maybe something else. You mentioned you've had people ask you for advice on parts of their business or other things. If you could just give some advice to our listeners, say, you know, if you're either an early stage entrepreneur thinking about doing it, what advice would you give those people?
It's a very good question because there's, you know, when I'd speak at entrepreneur conferences, I remember you'd come across someone, you'd discuss their idea with them and you'd be like, yeah, good idea. Then you see them a year later and how's business going? And they hadn't done anything about it. So the best advice for entrepreneurs, I think Nike has been printing on t-shirts for years, and that's just do it. That there are so many tools out there now. There are so many support networks. Venture capital is easier to get than ever before. And just take the steps necessary to launch something. It doesn't have to be perfect on day one. Get your idea out into the market and then start incrementing and improving. Test and learn.
There you go, advice from Rosalind Koga. Mate, my last one, we are, as you've already mentioned, in some tough times. People are doing it tough right now. Business is doing it tough. You guys probably better than most. But what are you optimistic about? If you kind of take the optimistic view and say, what is it that you're liking, feeling good about, feeling positive about, expecting better things from? What are you optimistic about, Rosalind?
Look, I think the news likes to paint conflict or, the bad news all the time. It's if Jack meets Jill at a conference and then they go out for lunch and, Jill punches Jack, then that's a headline and yes, that'll be all over the news. But if they meet at a conference and then they go out for lunch and become friends and then go watch the footy together, you'll never hear of that. Like, good news doesn't propagate as quickly. And if you look at all of the most important metrics about the world in terms of life expectancy, the poverty, the ability for people to access basic medicine or the, you know, things like that, like all of these key metrics, it's showing that the world is currently better than it's ever been. Like somebody living even in a third world country today often has better access to things than royalty in France of a few hundred years ago. So, you know, they'll have access to an air conditioner, they'll have access to vaccines and medication or, you know, and so on. So the world is a pretty good place. So there's like, if you look at the real core metrics, yes, we've got a lot of issues that we need to fix. And yes, we need to keep improving and getting better. But if you look at the core metrics, there's never been a better time in the history of the world, and we should all be working very hard to make it even better.
Mate, I love that. That is a wonderful way to finish up our podcast. Rosalind, thank you very much for spending time on the Good Oil podcast. That is Rosalind Kogan, of course, the CEO and founder of Kogan.com and Kogan the Business, of course, which owns more brands than just the Kogan website. If you do want to follow more from the Good Oil, please make sure you do like and subscribe to the podcast. You can jump on any of the socials. Just look up Good Oil Podcast and you'll find us on Insta, Twitter, Facebook. I'm not yet on TikTok, Rosalind. I probably won't do that, to be honest. The Good Oil Podcast anyway, or Good Oil Podcast, I should say. Look that up on the socials and make sure you follow us because we've got plenty of good guests coming up. I'm not sure they'll be able to beat Rosalind, but we are looking forward to bringing you more of these sorts of episodes. Rosalind, thank you again. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks a lot, Scott, and an absolute pleasure to chat. Thank you.
This podcast is hosted by me, Scott Phillips. It's produced excellently by Beth Gibson and audio imaged brilliantly by Link Kelly. Listener.